This is 地球好辣 Super Hot.
Hello everyone, this is your host Yu Ping.
And I'm James.
You are listening to Green Development and Taiwan. So this is the second time we had this conversation.
So I've traveled around Taiwan quite a bit in the past 3 years being here, but this was the first time actually being part of a roaming tour of the West Coast, visiting lots of different solar development sites, agrivoltaic sites, and aquavoltaic sites, and a few other interesting activities in between.
Mm.
It was a busy 3 days. It was 3 days constantly on the move.
Yeah, to begin with, it's because we suddenly have a Japanese visitor a month ago. Like everything went in the world. Like we decided to invite him firstly over online conversation meeting, and then we discovered that he's actually coming to Taiwan. So then we decided that in order for this particular friend, who's specialized in agrivoltaics in Japan, we need to let him have a proper exposure of Taiwan's situation. So that's how we started this whole field trip.
Yeah. And he's very active participant. And he joined us, as well as a host of 10 other rotating faces across the 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real big caravan of cars and special guests.
I was very tentative to call it a walking workshop.
Walking workshop.
Yeah, because I've been to this kind of workshop. It's not like one day in one room, but to visit different places.
Mm.
But you're supposed to be like the same group of people visiting different places and different faces. And then the group of people should be, it consists different background. It's not like the same team visiting different places. It's supposed to be several different team member, probably someone from academic background, some from NGOs, and some from the governmental sector, things like that. So that's what I had in mind.
Well, that's very much what it felt like. It didn't feel like necessarily field work where you're going out to collect information or do a experiment or research.
Yeah.
And you talk about people from different backgrounds, NGOs, academic, but there was also different people who had different interests in their backgrounds.
Mm.
So solar is becoming to be quite broad in its scope and its application.
Mm.
And you had people who had a focus and an interest on agrivoltaics, so agriculture and solar.
Yeah.
You had people who had experience and are interested in aquavoltaics, which is aquaculture and solar. And so you had a lot of different perspectives, and at times you think, what's the relevance to this to me? Then you realize, oh, actually, there's someone else here who's asking really interesting questions.
Yeah, yeah,
how
exactly.
Is being applied to agrivoltaics possibly be applied to aquavoltaics?
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah. So even though when we constructed the whole trip in a very limited time frame and resources, so there are some places or some schedule that's not ideal.
That's the experience that I felt this time in our walking workshop, is that you had a bit of time in the car rides between places to discuss and reflect with people, and also mealtime if someone joined us.
Mm.
And so it wasn't just, you know, the hour or two that we spend at a particular site speaking with the site developer or operator and getting an insight with them.
Yeah.
But then you also get to talk with it with the other people. And it felt more like an actual hands-on workshop discussion reflection instead of what workshops tend to be, which is just a networking event. And this 3-day walking workshop, it just did not feel like a networking event at all. It felt like, no, we're here to observe, to collect, to learn, and to engage.
True. And also because we are carrying this kind of workshop always initiated because there's summer coming, and so it's worth a particular event, the investment of money and time. And so because we have a foreign guest, Taiwanese people always want to learn or know about the right answer when it comes to experts from abroad, of how they would view in this particular Taiwanese problem. But in this walking workshop or in our trip, I refrain from asking Makoto or letting him exposed in that kind of scenario, like what would you do, what do you think this is, like that kind of thing. But still he got asked a lot.
He was there to observe and see what was happening in Taiwan rather than, oh look, this is the thing that we do, how would you fix it?
What's your opinion and things like
that? That's assuming that what the project happened in Taiwan is flawed in a way. But you know, from all the sites that we visit, you get the feeling that there's a lot of excitement and wanting to experiment with different applications of solar.
Did you?
I actually did.
I'm just joking.
I look at all of the different applications of solar. You know, not every agrivoltaic place was the same. Not every aquavoltaic place was the same.
Mm-hmm.
Even the photovoltaics, the floating solar panels, different.
Mm-hmm.
Sites that could potentially be developed for solar were very different to what I had in mind of agrivoltaics, of just some chickens running underneath a solar panel. Really? It was, lots of different interesting applications. And you get the feeling that, you know, framework besides, you know, a framework to actually allow people to experiment with different applications without bringing any impact to the local environment or to society at large. I think that's a different discussion.
Yeah.
But he's come to learn how Taiwanese are doing these applications.
Yes.
And so there really isn't a, this is a right, this is a wrong, this is a, we're all learning.
Yeah.
In Japan, they're learning.
Yeah. He's Australia actually a lot more tolerant than us, like a lot kinder than most of us. It's,
in what way?
It's a very, I think that's a kind of attitude in Taiwan we lack. Like we are so harsh to other people's mistake. And we are so defensive of our own flow. What I was trying to say is, like, in the particular, in terms of solar development or green renewable energy development in general, people in Taiwan are not ready to view the whole nation, everyone in this country as a whole. Like, we are all on the same boat. We should all be trying to do something. Instead, we are like, oh, whoever is a developer, they are greedy. And what they are doing, I'm going to, you know, just have a check. If it's not from my standard, whatever that standard is, perfect thing, then I would just target it. Same with the government. Of course, it's far from perfect, the current policy and everything. But then by only targeting the government of not doing enough, but not providing what they should do, is not really driving them further.
When you go on other field trips and this walking workshop, do you see that view changing at all? Do you see any open-mindedness or collaboration among the people that you go with, the people that you meet, or is that opinion formed from the field work and workshop? Because from my view, there seemed to be a lot of interest from the different parties that we were with and met, and I kind of see that they were open-minded, but I guess there were a bit of a language barrier, I guess. That I might have missed some things that they were discussing, if they were proud about something or if they came across not wanting to take any feedback. But you know, I found that the whole workshop, the walking workshop, was very collaborative in nature. And the worm house was one of the interesting applications or potential applications for solar that I saw along the way. It was in a farmhouse, open air-ish farmhouse shed that already had slanted rooftop, which would accommodate.
Perfect for solar.
Perfect for solar, exactly. And the farmer inside was growing earthworms and rotating the nutrients within soil.
Yeah. They are actually selling the soil that's produced by the earthworms.
Yeah.
Supposed to. Yeah.
And so they initially start off in styrofoam boxes,
mm-hmm.
and then moved on to columns on the floor.
Yeah.
Which then they slowly get the worms to shift from left to right to fix the nutrients within the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite interesting because you would see if there were solar panels there, it was quite a sizable rooftop space.
Yeah.
With an empty but working worm farm inside.
Yeah. Yeah. That one was interesting, but in among the group of us, 10-ish of us visiting, I think consisting of farmers, local farmers, people who's very familiar, working in the NGO and very familiar with the agriculture in general of Taiwan's situation, and people who used to work as a solar developing company, they were all in agreement that this is just to get the fact that this is an agriculture practice without really focusing on this particular agriculture, because that's not very professionally managed.
Mm.
And also there is not a big demand that we can imagine. We are aware of needing this kind of particular soil.
Yeah, it's a bit hard to classify that one. It's not your traditional or the idea that comes to mind of agrivoltaics, where something is being actively worked on the land and, you know, vegetation.
Yeah.
It's more of a rooftop application
with
an agricultural business underneath.
Yes.
And also with the scale of it, it would kind of lend itself to perhaps private investment to sell back to the grid rather than a developer coming in and...
Yeah.
And it... How what would you say the size for the potential capacity of that would be?
Yeah. And it doesn't sell to me like they are really making any profit.
Mm.
Yeah.
But if you apply that to however many sheds and businesses are like that around the western coast of Taiwan, it can add up. And every little bit counts, as we know.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit interesting when I talked to the Japanese friend Makoto of our secret opinion. He was like, speak it out to those people so that they can understand you and they can defend if they act the reality is different. I was like, I will encourage them, but they might not want to mention about this now, because they are still getting to know each other, and that's how things are like on the first day.
Mm.
And our first day, the team was like, there was different people getting to know each other, and so starting the friendship when it's still fresh out, we are not really eager to confront each other.
And this ties back to what we were talking about before. There's a bit of cultural context that you need to know. You can look outside of Taiwan for ideas, and you can have people coming in to look at what's happening here. But at the end of the day, you still need to understand the local context and how people may respond to your suggestions and your ideas of what their practices are.
Yeah.
You know, build up the relationship and then feed it to them a bit later.
Yeah.
And so after the worm farm, We then visited
an almost abandoned agrivoltaic site. It's not abandoned, it's still functioning. It's just, it's mysterious for us of what agriculture underneath.
It's a cute little site. It's like a tree nursery. A nursery to grow little trees that can become pot plants, and they put solar over the top. You know, it wasn't a greenhouse. It wasn't a dual use, you know, mounted in the ground. It was kind of sitting on a cage, so nothing could get to the trees. Yeah.
Supposed to be a smart design. The thing is, the agriculture underneath is definitely not really a serious business.
Mm.
Yeah, so you can tell it's not seriously.
I'd say not. It's not serious in the fact that it probably takes 3, 4, 5 years for any of the sapling to actually grow into a tree that's large enough to sell.
Well, if you plant trees like that, you will not get fruit. I mean,
Were they fruiting trees?
Supposed to be, but fruiting trees should grow a lot quicker than that, because that one was like 5 years ago, and the tree was like that. I mean, what kind of fruit trees takes more than 5 years to grow and still like that?
It'd be interesting if that site had a test site to see what the difference between a...
It looks like they replanted so that they are so small.
Whether there has been a bit of stunting of the growth, or if that's the actual rate that it grows in that soil in that lighting condition.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after that, we went to what I would consider to be the vision I have when you think agriculture, agrivoltaics. And so that was a site that had two different companies working on it.
Mm-hmm.
One was looking at low-density solar agrivoltaic, and one was looking at a higher-density agrivoltaic.
The calculated coverage rate was similar.
Similar?
Yeah, 30%. Around 30%. You are allowed to have 40%, but they decided... Well, you are actually... There's no limitation because it's not farmland, technically speaking. Yeah. But by their proposal, they would try 40%, 30%, and so to just try the ideal rate. Yeah, so they are more or less, they claim to be more or less similar in that way, the coverage rate.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So on the first site, they were organized in a chessboard.
Chessboard.
Smaller panels.
Uh-huh.
And underneath they were growing pumpkin.
Yeah.
Pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, they were your traditional large size solar PV panels.
Traditional
as opposed to the small ones that looked like could fit on top of a car.
Right. The traditional one with it's movable.
The panel itself was on an axis.
Yeah,
on a mechanical axis.
Yeah.
And they had split up into 30% coverage, 35, and I believe up to 40.
Okay.
And they also had, most of the panels were single-sided.
Yeah.
And they also had some rows that were double-sided.
Mm.
And underneath, they were growing elephant grass and sweet potato.
Yeah. Sweet potato in the future. Which one do you like? Would you prefer? Like, vote for?
Well, it depends what I want to grow. You know, from the tilting solar panel side, you know, it grew elephant grass nearly all the way up to the back side of the solar panel. So if I really wanted to grow elephant grass, then perhaps...
Then that's a good one.
It'd be interesting to see how other crops grow underneath it, because that would be where the potential really gets unlocked.
Most of our other companions, they would vote for the tilting one. Because you can always raise the height and widen the gap and do whatever you want to suit the particular crop you want. The thing is, for the other one, they cannot, because it looks more expensive, complicated, and difficult to, it's not, it's less flexible in adapting crops. It's supposed to be also flexible in, because it's chessboard composition.
And it has a higher height, so it seems like you can have more
mobility. Yeah, 3 meter high. Underneath. Yeah.
But it actually requires, or at least that site, it required more material.
Yeah.
And there are a lot more support beams between.
Yeah.
Which means that there's actually a lot of more equipment to navigate underneath.
Yes, yes. It makes you, you are totally aware of that.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, need to, it's just, it's probably not a very easy and happy place for a farmer to work on, the environment. Yeah. So, but their original idea was actually to build a happy place for farmers to, you know, use the machine and have an easy life.
So that was the first day.
Yeah.
And then the second day, I was feeling a bit under the weather. So.
Poor James.
we started off with a visit to the wetlands.
Yeah.
Where were the wetlands exactly?
In Budai, in Jiayi. The first day we went, we started from the very north point of Zhanghua on the coastline, and then we went to Yunling, stay overnight in Jiayi, and the second day we start from Jiayi, also on the, along the coastline. There are a lot of salt pan wetlands now that used to be a kind of agricultural land. It produces sea salt,
which is a food.
It's like in the old days, it's like 3,000 hectares of the land in the southwest area, and it was during the Japanese colonization period. The Japanese took over as like for 50 years or so, and they built a lot of things. And so sea salt company including, and so they recruited most of the land. I think most of them are wasted then, back then, like just a part of the coastline wetland, and they recruited it and put them into like a flat land, monohonious kind of flat area, and produced the sea salt. And it was still in function after the Japanese left, and we created some more afterward, and then but the whole industry collapsed, closed by around 2002, when the only company, it's quite recently, like 20 years ago. It's not because there's no business, it's just there are easier way to make the same profit if you only count for domestic need. So they just decided to close all of the land, and then they have an indoor facility, the industry, a factory using electricity to generate sea salt. So it was a fighting place several years ago when we started this renewable energy development process pathway. They saw, we have thousands of wasteland, so it will be like piece of cake to finish the first stage of 20 gigawatt of solar development. At the end, they only get like less than 300 hectares. The biggest one was the one that we visited, 80 hectares in total. Because those salt pan, after they were closed 20 years ago, gradually became ideal habitat or alternative habitat for the seabird migrating into Taiwan. Most of the other wetland in Taiwan were gradually disappearing, like, or abruptly disappearing when we had even bigger industrial development. So what do you think after you, well, the 3 hours wasn't very
I spent most of the time in the car.
In a car.
Hiding from the sun. Because I was very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But from what I could see out the window, it didn't seem like there was a whole lot of restoration.
Okay.
But I don't know what to compare it against.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It didn't require a lot of restoration. It only requires water to come in and out as tides come in and out, like normal wetland. Because it's artificially built, like they intentionally blocks the water or attract the water from other, draw the water from other places when they were having this whole operational the soil pan in operation. So when they closed it, some of the places were left without water coming in. Some are having water all the time, that kind of thing. So it's the water gate that's the most crucial in that area where they have to manage. And the lady who's in who is responsible for the restoration project was actually telling us she's responsible for 5 different soil pan in that area, and they have their OR by appearance quite similar to each other, but in a closer look and inspection you will see they all have different difficulty. The barriers are very different.
Yeah.
Some requires negotiation with the local farmer fishermen, because the fishermen are now in control of the water gate for their own use, and that might be in conflict with the conservational use. Some are because of the governmental regulation, and they don't have, they have by law, they are the governmental irrigational system, they are responsible for maybe fishermen's requirement or flooding system management and the like, nothing about conservation. So
yeah
they would be, they would be the kind of people who they need to consider. And yeah, it's an added fact.
My question for you then would be, even though the bird site and the wetland and the lady who took us around for the 3 hours, not exactly connected with solar developers, but she still has to manage a lot of different stakeholders.
Yes.
From your conversation with her, did you think or gain any insight into how, you know, how you could manage conflicts, manage stakeholders and speak to stakeholders? Did you learn anything from her and how that could be applied to the aquavoltaic, agrivoltaic solar developments in Taiwan?
It's exactly why we visited her. On the one hand, it's because she would put aquavoltaics or solar development also in like regarding as the focal things in whatever happening in her area, she would be very paying attention to, and she would be the prime stakeholder for the developers to consult on. That's how important she is, because we more or less during the past few years putting conservational issue on the same platform with the solar energy development, and particularly in those areas. So it's not only with the fisheries, the need of the fishermen, and also the need of conservational system, conservational needs. So the reason that she can now work only for restoration of the salt pan was because we successfully in together, but she as the core member successfully persuaded the government and the developers that the conservational need of this salt pan landscape was very important. Yeah, and so she can get money from the developers when they develop that particular solar farm, and also the other developers when they have aquavoltaics in the nearby area, their company or relating company would donate to that particular project, because then they can tell the audience that we tried our best to, you know, yeah, we put the burden on someone else. We just give money to her. So that's, in a way, make life easier for solo development, because if you don't have that mechanism functioning, then local people or NGOs as a whole in Taiwan would always be targeting the developers of not regarding to the environment. In a way, they cannot do. Whenever they set up a place, there's always a loss of habitat in that particular area.
Yeah.
So that's the most important thing, that why we talk to her. And her experience in talking to different, well, receiving different opinion, and I think the way he managed focusing on her goal and encouraging other people to participate along the way, not really pushing people away, but absorbing, like drawing people to her team, that is just like amazing. Like, this is very rare character. Yeah, very inspirational. And whenever we ask for her guidance or her her opinion, she's like always willing to spend time with us. She's just very warm.
And so it's good to have some of that insight before we went to the solar development site after. Which was quite a large development. It was around 40
Which gigawatt? One? The Vina Energy?
Yeah, the Vina Energy.
That one has 80 hectares.
80 hectares.
It's transferred into solar, and another, like, supposedly 30% of the whole area. So it's more than 100 hectares, I think. Wow. I'm not so sure. Anyway, so it's quite big.
And so going to the site and having a bit of an overview of its development, but seeing how they've tried to engage and understand that they are located in a pretty sensitive area, and they have that in their education center of the species that you can find nearby. Again, probably another language barrier, and also my inability to concentrate very hard that day.
Of that day.
That day. Other days less so. Was perhaps I missed something of what they're actually doing to help be part of the conservation or part of the restoration. Is that something that they had mentioned or something that you're aware of?
They mentioned about they are a part of the conservation.
Well, from the education center,
yeah,
you get the impression that they're aware of the bird and the fish species nearby. But I was more curious as to what they actually do. If they actually work with her or other NGOs, or if there are any...
Well, there's a very interesting story behind the lady told us beforehand, saying when they first went to Vina back then, before everything started, talking to them about the whole situation and drawing the governmental agency to come and negotiate. It's like a stakeholder meeting of several, a serious stakeholder meetings initiated, well, pressed by the NGO and local people like her, and initiated by the government, and of course the developers are there. They were present there, and they agreed on the condition that they will take care of the conservational need by stating that they will preserve 30% of the place for conservational use. So the lady said after that agreement, she approached the developer, the Vina Energy, and asked them, so what are you going to do with the 30% of the land you reserved? And they were like, you can just we will make sure the 30% of land will be untouched. Like, untouched. We won't touch it at all. And she was like, I was super stressed when I heard this, because that's almost like a death sentence for a particular land.
Yeah. You know, land needs to be maintained or improved.
Yeah.
Worked on, not just untouched.
Yeah. So she's like telling them, no, untouched is unacceptable. And so on and so forth, until they in turn talk to her like, so what's your suggestion? And she brought like the bird organization, who's now in collaboration with her, to tell Davina the most important thing from her experience in that area was the water coming in and out, and how to secure it, how to find a better solution to maintain the remaining portion of the previous area, and probably during the construction period as well, that will change the water level most of the time. Yeah, the kind of detailed things.
Yeah. My biggest takeaway from those two sites was just to remember that it's not just energy, like how can we apply energy? It's, we also have to remember there's an environment that we're building in.
Yeah.
And there's other stakeholders and other people who are really cautious about this as well, you know. Yeah. In time we look at spatial planning and the role of society being involved.
Yeah.
We also have to remember that there are other animals and other species living where we want to build.
Yeah.
And it's great that we have people like her who are so actively involved and willing to contribute her knowledge and her time to not just improving the environment for the people of nearby and for the animals, but also collaborating with energy companies, solar companies that are taking that land.
Yeah.
It's a really important thing to remember. Yeah.
And later on, that one, that particular solar farm became a kind of model. Mm. So when we talk about Aigui model, that means 30% of the land reserved for conservational uses. But there's a problem applying that if the farm was not big enough, and also why is it 30%? So it's not something that you can, you know, just multiply in other places. Yeah. Like the last day when we went to the aquavoltaic, that one was actually we involved in the previous in the initial process of deciding whether this land proposal, this proposal was good enough or proper enough, and we were like negotiating with them of preserving a certain piece of habitat for the ducks. And they were like, yeah, of course. So how much do they need? And I was like, this is the core area, and that is the combining site that they need in for the ducks. They are sensitive to human movement. And they were like, okay, cool area, done, seven hectare. But not the others. But we'll make sure that we won't, be too busy around there. And it's just, at the end, it's not big enough, because it's a significantly smaller site than the Vina farm. So even though they kind of reserve a portion of it, it's just not enough. And it also depends on what kind of things the conservation goals is about. For Vina, it's about maintaining the quality of the originally so pen to a certain level for all kinds of birds who come in and migratory birds to use. And for the smaller one, it's for the ducks' regional population to stay overnight. And yeah, so it's totally different, but developers found it difficult to understand the context behind.
So you mentioned the third day we visited two and a half aquavoltaic sites.
Yeah,
first was a
very busy
floating voltaic site, which was built on private land that was legally fish acquired pond. Fish pond.
Mm.
But there was a bit of social conflict there.
Yeah.
With over spoiling of the natural view.
Well, it's not telling the villagers beforehand that this is designated as a secondary farmland.
Yeah,
just a part of this, not all of this place, but just part of this. So maybe someone is not happy with their land not being in it. Some of us previous tenants are not happy of this being designated as that. And and of course, that's very close to the temple and the village. Yeah.
And they didn't tell them because it wasn't a legal requirement to do so.
Yes.
You know, there's probably another cultural difference here is if the law says I don't have to do it, I'm just not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Versus a voluntary, perhaps we should engage with the community over this.
Yeah.
And you would think that just because you don't have to do something, you think it's going to be easier.
Yeah.
But sometimes being voluntary and transparent, not sometimes, probably a lot of the time, it's going to be easier. Because when you want to start building and someone's standing in the middle of the road stopping your truck or, you know, trying to pull out the panels that you're putting in, you know, if you were transparent and voluntary with the information you give, because there's a lack of a legal requirement to do so, you could have avoided a lot of the problems.
I'm not sure the developers experience the same way as you did. I mean, this is really a social thing.
Mm.
Like, our people is not... When we first came in, when we were doing that aquavoltaic site, that when they were proposing that particular site, and we were like, just do it openly. And they were like, do you have an idea of how they will respond to you? If you have an open consultation, they will just throw at you any kind of things, like chairs or...
Oh, things, not like...
Yeah, things. Yeah, they will send people to block you and things like that. Just make that like a real mess. But at the end, when we insist on having this open consultation, it's less scary as they imagine it would be. But that's the kind of thing. They imagine things would be terrible. So whatever they can do to avoid that confrontation, they would try to just sneak away.
And that fish pond was quite... It was very close to the community.
Yeah.
Essentially, there were structures and houses and temple all overlooking this pond. The other two aquaculture sites we visited were a little bit removed from, like, they weren't embedded within the community. You know, you had to drive down the road. You might be able to see a house or two. But I'm curious that with the second site we visited, if there was any conflict over that. I know we talked about the final one with the lone house built in the middle of the... which is an interesting story. But with before we get to that one, to the second site, are you aware of any...
Yeah, comparing with all the others, there were 7 proposals in the same year, more or less in a similar area, in the same area, and having the similar things to consider about. Yeah. But that particular one that we went has a lot less people issue.
We're looking at the small sample size we've just used there. It seems to be a bit of a correlation between proximity to the community and the development and the amount of contest there is. You know, kind of is a, to me at least, a straight line between, oh, if I'm going to do something close to people, I should probably engage them. Voluntary or not, or like I should have, whether it's not me or the developer, but having someone else go in and, you know, trying to see what local opinions might be.
I think that's because we were not trained to, you know, talk to each other rationally, like, and make and then reach to a kind of general consensus of what we all agree on, what we don't agree, and how we are going to solve this disagreement in the future. Like back to what I mentioned, I had an interesting experience of participating in another walking workshop talking about Indigenous people's rights in co-governance of their own territory. This is something very difficult for the government to understand how it can work on, because that means most of the time it's a committee, and the committee would consist of half of the members from the village, from the tribe, half from the government. And people from the government, they rotate. Whoever is on that position, he would need to come to the committee. Whereas the villager side, they would also decide how they would generate this representative. Anyway, so it's like 12 or so people's committee. They would decide on how they would co-govern the whole area. So the idea is they have the chair rotating between these two party, and the because Indigenous people, they normally have a way to talk among themselves because it's not written regulation they used to have.
It's a social contact.
Yeah, so they are very used to have long dialogue of what you think and what they think and how are we going to. The chief is always very good at that. So they normally have a good idea of how they want to have a representative, and it's the government they have to learn. And so the government was always like, the professor said he has experience in many places. The government was so tired of having long conversation in that committee and not reaching much conclusion.
Yeah.
So there's always many things in disagreement, only one or two in agreement and minor things. But that was very good as a starting point, because then you can act on the ones that's in agreement, and then you can on the same meeting, on the next meeting you can negotiate on following. But the government side was always not patient enough. So when they are the acting chair, they normally want to, you know, do things like
push things through.
In a 2 hours meeting, and like. So they force, like, by voting or so to have a conclusion. And that conclusion would not be carried out because people are not ready for that.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's the same thing for this. The developers in Taiwan, they are not used to, they cannot imagine putting things in front of people would have any good result. They think people were just targeting you and demanding things from you, not really giving advices and it's meaningful enough to listen. So that's the attitude that's hard to change if they never get to exposing.
And I think it's a problem that's probably not unique to other developments in these areas, but unique for solar when comparing it to something like wind, offshore wind particularly, because a lot of the developers for offshore wind, they're the big European companies where they have their European sense of development and culture that does have these methods and processes of wanting to engage with social. They're built in areas that have been designated. So the only big conflict is with, say, fishers, which will have its own process. But from the walking workshop that we had, every site that we went to, every application was a different community, a different setting. And that's the exciting thing about solo, but also the hardest thing is that it will be everywhere, especially in Taiwan. We're going to have to have a dual use, either if it's on rooftops, agriculture, aquaculture, and there's going to be discussions needed to be made, otherwise there'll be things thrown.
True. So this is just the trip. for you would just be a beginning of getting to know the reality in Taiwan.
Mm.
Like, yeah, so.
There's a difference between reading it while being overseas.
Or hearing us or, complaining about this. Or reading it
here and engaging with other academics and researchers. And then when you're actually there, uh-huh. there's three levels of engaging with it. It's been very, very, very good.
Yeah, so we had a very meaningful, interesting, intense weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we were thinking of maybe we will have another one in the coming months. Hopefully the weather will be milder.
Hopefully. A bit more clouds.
Yeah, so but so far this is just like whenever we go into those particular sites and learning what's going on, you get to have I get that kind of anxious, particularly anxious for that particular, for each of the particular sites. And if there's conflicts going on, you feel like, oh, what if we can come in earlier? What if things are differently done? What really can... Because you mentioned there are different contexts in each of the different places, but we are dealing with consistent decision-making process. Like, they neglect the particular character in each of this sites. And that's making none of this ideal enough.
Yeah.
During the process. Yeah. So it's just it's something we are trying to come up with a better way. Do you have any final words to describe final the words. Trip?
I'm not too sure who listens or.
Jiawei listens. No, he doesn't.
But I would say if you're not going out into... obviously, if you're listening, you're interested in the issues we've talked about.
Mm.
And if you're not going out into the field or doing some sort of tour to where these sites are being developed, find a way to do so.
Mm.
You know, it's a bit hard to do it personally. You don't want to just go... Oh, look, from the car, that's you're not going to know the developer side of the story or the ecologist side of the story or the farmer side of the story. You need to be able to engage with these people.
Yeah.
And not just look at the structure.
So this kind of stories from the press, then you normally always hear just one side or two, but it's always multiple sides. And it's the most interesting is when you put them together, like you put different stakeholders together, so they know each other and well, they meet each other and they try to present their point of view and listen to others, and they will be different from there, and that's very rare thing in Taiwan. Yeah, so we need to encourage that kind of meaningful dialogue to happen more frequently. We hope you are there. But we are happy enough to just talk among us. So, hope you enjoy our conversation. Until next time. Bye.
James, thank you.